My guess is not long, said Ada. After the Pearl Girls scoop you, Garth can't go along. But they'll coddle you like an egg. You'll be one more precious pearl on their string.
But once you get to Gilead, it might be different, said Elijah. You'll have to wear what they tell you to wear, watch what you say, and be alert to their customs.
If you know too much to begin with, though, Ada said, they'll suspect us of training you, so it'll need to be a fine balance. I thought about this. Was I clever enough? I don't know if I can do that.
If in doubt, play dumb, said Ada.
Have you sent any pretend converts in there before?
A couple, said Elijah, with mixed results, but they didn't have the protection you'll have.
You mean from the source?
The source. All I could picture was a person with a bag over their head. Who were they, really? The more I heard about the source, the weirder they sounded.
Guesswork, but we think it's one of the aunts, said Ada.
Mayday didn't know much about the aunts. They weren't in the news, not even the Gilead news. It was the commanders who gave the orders, made the laws, and did the talking. The aunts worked behind the scenes. That's all we were told at school.
They're said to be very powerful, said Elijah. But that's hearsay. We don't have a lot of details.
Ada had a few pictures of them, but only a few. Aunt Lydia, Aunt Elizabeth, Aunt Vidala, Aunt Helena. These were their so-called founders.
Pack of evil harpies, she said.
Great, I said.
Sounds like fun.
Garth said that once we were on the street, I needed to follow orders, because he was the one with the street smarts. I wouldn't want to provoke other people into fighting with him, so saying things like, "Who was your slave last year?" and "You're not the boss of me," would not be good.
I haven't said stuff like that since I was 8, I said.
You said both of them yesterday, said Garth.
I should choose another name, he said. People might be looking for a Daisy, and I certainly couldn't be Nicole. So I said I'd be Jade. I wanted something harder than a flower.
The source said she needs to get a tattoo on her left forearm, Ada said. It's always been a non-negotiable demand.
I'd tried for a tattoo when I was 13, but Melanie and Neil had been strongly against it.
Cool, but why? I asked now.
There's no bare arms in Gilead, so who's going to see it?
We think it's for the Pearl Girls, said Ada, when they pick you up. They'll be directed to look specially for it.
Will they know who I am? Like the Nicole thing? I asked.
They just follow instructions, said Ada. Don't ask, don't tell.
What tattoo should I get?
A butterfly?
That was a joke, but nobody laughed.
The source said it should look like this, said Ada. She sketched it.
Love, vertical. God, horizontal. Intersecting at the O.
I can't have that on my arm, I said. It's wrong for me to have it.
It was so hypocritical. Neil would have been shocked.
Maybe it's wrong for you, said Ada, but it's right for the situation.
Ada brought in a woman she knew to do the tattoo and the rest of my street makeover. She had pastel green hair, and the first thing she did was tint my hair the same shade. I was pleased. I thought I looked like some dangerous avatar from a video game.
It's a start, said Ada, evaluating the results.
The tattoo wasn't just a tattoo. It was a scarification. Raised lettering. It hurt like shit. But I tried to act as if it didn't, because I wanted to show Garth that I was up to it. In the middle of the night, I had a bad thought. What if the source was only a decoy, meant to deceive Mayday? What if there was no important document cache? Or what if the source was evil? What if the whole story was a trap, a clever way of luring me into Gilead? I'd go in and I wouldn't be able to get out.
Then there would be a lot of marching, with flags and choir singing and praying, and giant rallies like the ones we'd seen on TV. And I would be the centerpiece. Baby Nicole, back where she belonged. Hallelujah. Smile for Gilead TV. In the morning, while I was eating my greasy breakfast with Ada, Elijah, and Garth, I told them about this fear.
We've considered the possibility, said Elijah. It's a gamble.
It's a gamble every time you get up in the morning, said Ada.
This is a more serious gamble, Elijah said.
I'm betting on you, Garth said.
It'll be so amazing if you win.
Part 13. Secateurs.
The Ardua Hall Holograph. Chapter 34. My reader, I have a surprise for you. It was also a surprise for me. Under cover of darkness, and with the aid of a stone drill, some pliers, and a little mortar patching, I installed two battery-run surveillance cameras in the base of my statue. I have always been good with tools. I replaced the moss carefully, reflecting that I should really get my replica cleaned. Moss adds respectability only up to a point. I was beginning to look furry. I waited with some impatience for the results. It would be a fine thing to have a stash of irrefutable pictures of Aunt Elizabeth planting evidence in the form of hard-boiled eggs and oranges at my stone feet in an effort to discredit me. Even though I myself was not performing these acts of idolatry, the fact that others were performing them would reflect badly on me. It would be said that I had tolerated these acts, and I might even have encouraged them. Such aspersions might well be used by Elizabeth to lever me off my pinnacle. I was under no illusions as to Commander Judd's loyalty to me. If a safe means could be found, safe for him, he would not hesitate to denounce me. He's had a lot of practice in the denouncing business. But here is the surprise. There were several days of no activity, or none to speak of, since I discount the three tearful young wives granted access to the grounds because they were married to prominent eyes, who offered in toto a muffin, a small loaf of cornmeal bread, and two lemons. Like gold these days, lemons, considering the disasters in Florida and our inability to gain ground in California. I am glad to have them and shall make good use of them. If life gives you lemons, make lemonade. I shall also determine how these lemons were come by. It is ineffectual to try to clamp down on all gray market activities. The commanders must have their little perks. But I naturally wish to know who is selling what and how it is smuggled in. Women are only one of the commodities. I hesitate to call them commodities, but when money is in the picture, such they are, that are being relocated undercover. Is it lemons in and women out? I shall consult my gray market sources. They don't like competition. These tearful wives wished to enlist my arcane powers in their quest for fertility, poor things. Per ardua cum estrus, they intoned, as if Latin could have more effect than English. I will see what can be done for them, or rather who can be done, their husbands having proven so singularly feeble in that respect. But back to my surprise. On the fourth day, what should loom into the camera's field of vision just as dawn was breaking but the large red nose of Aunt Vidala, followed by her eyes and mouth. The second camera provided a longer shot. She was wearing gloves, cunning of her, and from a pocket she produced an egg, followed by an orange. Having looked about her to make sure no one was watching, she placed these votive offerings at my feet, along with a small plastic baby. Then, on the ground beside the statue, she dropped a handkerchief embroidered with lilacs, a well-known prop of mine from Aunt Vidala's school project some years ago, in which the girls embroidered sets of handkerchiefs for the senior aunts, with flowers signaling their names. I have lilacs, Elizabeth has echinacea, Helena has hyacinth, Vidala herself has violets. Five for each of us, such a lot of embroidery. But this idea was thought to skirt dangerously close to reading and was discontinued. Now, having previously told me that Elizabeth was trying to incriminate me, Vidala herself was placing the evidence against me, this innocent piece of handicraft. Where had she got it? From pilfering the laundry, I suppose. Facilitating the heretical worship of myself. What a stellar denunciation! You can imagine my delight. Any false step by my main challenger was a gift from destiny. I filed away the photos for possible future use. It is always desirable to save whatever scraps may come to hand, in kitchens as elsewhere, and determined to await developments. My esteemed founder colleague Elizabeth must soon be told that Vidala was accusing her of treachery. Should I add Helena as well? Who was the more dispensable if a sacrifice must be made? Who might be the most easily co-opted if the need arose? How might I best set the members of the triumvirate eager to overthrow me against one another? All the better to pick them off one by one. And where did Helena actually stand vis-a-vis myself? She'd go with the zeitgeist, whatever that might prove to be. She was always the weakest of the three. I approach a turning point. The wheel of fortune rotates, fickle as the moon. Soon, those who were down will move upwards, and vice versa, of course. I would inform Commander Judd that baby Nicole, now a young girl, is finally almost within my grasp and may shortly be enticed to Gilead. I will say almost, and may, to keep him in suspense. He will be more than excited, since he has long understood the propaganda virtues of a repatriated baby Nicole. I will say that my plans are well underway, but that I would prefer not to share them at present. It is a delicate calculation, and a careless word in the wrong place could ruin all. The Pearl Girls are involved, and they are under my supervision. They are part of the special women's sphere in which heavy-handed men should not meddle, I will say, wagging a finger at him roguishly. Soon the prize will be yours. Trust me on this. I will warble. Aunt Lydia, you are too good, he will beam. Too good to be true, I will think. Too good for this earth. Good, be thou my evil. For you to understand how matters are currently developing, I will now provide you with a little history. An incident that passed almost unnoticed at the time. 9 years ago, or thereabouts, it was the same year my statue was unveiled, though not in the same season, I was in my office, tracing the bloodlines for a proposed marriage, when I was interrupted by the appearance of Aunt Lise. She of the fluttering eyelashes and the pretentious hairstyle, a modified French roll. As she was ushered into my office, she was nervously wringing her hands. I was ashamed of her for being so novelistic. "Aunt Lydia, I am truly sorry for taking up your valuable time," she began. They all say that, but it never stops them. I smiled in what I hoped was not a forbidding manner. "What is the problem?" I said. There is a standard repertoire of problems, wives at war with one another, daughters in rebellion, commanders dissatisfied with the wife selection proposed, handmaids on the run, births gone wrong. The occasional rape, which we punish severely if we choose to make it public. Or a murder. He kills her, she kills him, she kills her, and once in a while, he kills him. Among the iconoclasts, jealous rage can take over, and knives can be wielded. But among the elect, male-on-male murders are metaphorical. A stab in the back. On slow days, I catch myself longing for something really original. A case of cannibalism, for instance. But then I reprimand myself. Be careful what you wish for. I have wished for various things in the past and have received them. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, as used to be said. Though in the present day, the idea of God laughing is next door to blasphemy. An ultra-serious fellow, God is now. We've had another suicide attempt among the premarital preparatory students at Ruby's, said Aunt Lise, tucking back a wandering strand of hair. She had removed the ungainly babushka-like head covering we are obliged to wear in public to avoid inflaming men, although the idea of any men being inflamed either by Aunt Lise, impressive of profile but alarmingly puckered, or by me, with my graying thatchery and sack of potatoes body, is so ludicrous that it hardly needs articulating. Not a suicide, not again, I thought. But Aunt Lise had said attempt, which meant that the suicide had not succeeded. There is always an inquiry when they do succeed, and fingers are pointed at Ardua Hall. Inappropriate mate selection is the usual accusation, we at the Hall being responsible for making the first cut, since we hold the bloodline's information. Opinions vary, however, as to what is, in fact, appropriate. What was it this time? Anti-anxiety medication overdose? I wish the wives wouldn't leave those pills strewn around where anyone can get hold of them. Those and the opiates. Such a temptation. Or did she try to hang herself? Not hanging, said Aunt Lise. She attempted to slash her wrists with the secateurs, the ones I use for the flower arranging. That's direct, at any rate, I said. What happened then? Well, she didn't slash very deeply, though there was a lot of blood and a certain amount of noise. Ah. By noise, she meant screaming. So unladylike. And then I called in the paramedics, and they sedated her and took her to the hospital. Then I notified the proper authorities. Quite right. Guardians or eyes? Some of each. I nodded. You seem to have handled it in the best way possible. What is there left to consult me about? Aunt Lise looked happy because I praised her, but she quickly changed her facial expression to deeply concerned. She says she will try it again if, unless there's a change in plan. Change in plan? I knew what she meant, but it's best to require clarity. Unless the wedding is called off, said Aunt Lise. We have counselors, I said. They've done their job? They've tried all the usual methods, with no success. You threatened her with the ultimate? She says she's not afraid of dying. It's living she objects to, under the circumstances. Is it this particular candidate she objects to, or marriage in general? In general, said Aunt Lise, despite the benefits. Flower arrangement was no inducement, I said dryly. Aunt Lise sets great store by it. It was not. Was it the prospect of childbirth? I could understand that, the mortality rate being what it is, of newborns primarily, but also of mothers. Complications set in, especially when the infants are not normally shaped. We had one the other day with no arms, which was interpreted as a negative comment by God upon the mother. No, not childbirth, said Aunt Lise. She says she likes babies. What then? I liked to make her blurt it out. It's good for Aunt Lise to confront reality once in a while. She spends too much time diddling around among the petals. She fiddled with the hair strand again. I don't like to say it. She looked down at the floor. Go ahead, I said. You won't shock me. She paused, flushed, cleared her throat. Well, it's the penises. It's like a phobia. Penises, I said thoughtfully. Them again. In attempted suicides of young girls, this is often the case. Perhaps we need to change our educational curriculum, I thought. Less fear-mongering, Fewer centaur-like ravishers and male genitalia bursting into flame. But if we were to put too much emphasis on the theoretical delights of sex, the result would almost certainly be curiosity and experimentation, followed by moral degeneracy and public stonings. No chance she might be brought to see the item in question as a means to an end? As a prelude to babies? None whatever, said Aunt Lise firmly. That has been tried. Submission of women as ordained from the moment of creation? Everything we could think of. You tried the sleep deprivation and 20-hour prayer sessions with relays of supervisors? She is adamant. She also says she has received a calling to higher service, though as we know they often use that excuse. But I was hoping that you... I sighed. There is little point in the destruction of a young female life for no reason, I said. Will she be able to learn the reading and writing? Is she intelligent enough? Oh, yes. Slightly too intelligent, said Aunt Lise. Too much imagination. I believe that's what happened concerning those things. Yes, the thought experiment penises can get out of control, I said. They take on a life of their own. I paused. Aunt Lise fidgeted. We'll admit her on probation, I said finally. Give her 6 months and see if she can learn. As you know, we need to replenish our numbers here at Ardua Hall. We of the older generation cannot live forever. But we must proceed carefully. One weak link. I am familiar with these exceptionally squeamish girls. It's no use forcing them. They can't accept bodily reality. Even if the wedding night is accomplished, they will soon be found swinging from a light fixture or in a coma under a rose bush, having swallowed every pill in the house. Thank you, said Aunt Lise. It would have been such a shame. To lose her, you mean? Yes, said Aunt Lise. She has a soft heart. That is why she is assigned to the flower arranging and so forth. In her past life, she was a professor of French literature of the 18th century, pre-revolution. Teaching the Ruby's premarital preparatory students is the closest she will ever come to having a salon. I try to suit the occupations to the qualifications. It's better that way, and I am a great proponent of better, in the absence of best, which is how we live now. And so I had to involve myself in the case of the girl Becca. It's always advisable for me to take a personal interest at the beginning with these suicidal girls who claim they wish to join us. Aunt Lise brought her to my office. A thin girl, pretty in a delicate way, with large, luminous eyes and her left wrist in a bandage. She was still wearing the green outfit of a bride-to-be. Come in, I said to her. I won't bite. She flinched as if she doubted this. You may take that chair, I said. Aunt Lise will be right beside you. Hesitantly, she sat down, knees together modestly, hands folded in her lap. She gazed at me mistrustfully. So you want to become an aunt, I said. She nodded. It's a privilege, not an entitlement. I assume you understand that. And it's not a reward for your silly attempt to end your own life. That was a mistake, as well as an affront to God. I trust it won't happen again, supposing we take you in. A shake of the head, a single tear, which she did not brush away. Was it a display tear? Was she trying to impress me? I asked Aunt Lise to wait outside. Then I launched into my spiel. Becca was being offered a second chance in life, I said, but both she and we needed to be sure that this was the right way for her, since the life of an aunt was not for everyone. She must promise to obey the orders of her superiors. She must apply herself to a difficult course of studies, as well as to the mundane chores assigned. She must pray for guidance every night and every morning. Then, after 6 months, if this was indeed her true choice, and if we ourselves were satisfied with her progress, she would take the Ardua Hall vow and renounce all other possible paths. And even then she would be only a supplicant aunt, until the successful completion of her Pearl Girls missionary work abroad, which would not happen for many years. Was she willing to do all these things?
Oh, yes, said Becca. She was so grateful. She would do anything that was required. We had saved her from... She stumbled to a halt, blushing.
Did something unfortunate happen to you in your earlier life, my child, I asked. Something involving a man.
I don't want to talk about it, she said. She was paler than ever.
You're afraid you'll be punished? A nod from her. You can tell me, I said. I have heard many disagreeable stories. I do understand some of what you may have been through. But she was still reluctant, so I did not push it. The mills of the gods grind slowly, I said, but they grind exceeding small.
Pardon? She looked puzzled.
I mean that whoever it was, his behavior will be punished in time. Put it out of your mind. You will be safe with us here. You will never be troubled by him again. We aunts do not work openly in such cases, but we work. Now, I hope you'll prove that you are deserving of the trust I have placed in you, I said.
Oh, yes, she said. I will be deserving.
These girls are all like that at the beginning, limp with relief, abject, prostrate. That can change over time, of course. We've had renegades. We've had backdoor sneakings to meet ill-advised Romeos. We've had disobedient flights. The endings of such stories have not usually been happy. Aunt Lise will take you to get your uniform, I said. Tomorrow you will have your initial reading lesson, and you will begin to learn our rules. But now you should select your new name. There is a list of suitable names available. Off you go. Today is the first day of the rest of your life, I said as cheerfully as I could.
I can't thank you enough, Aunt Lydia, said Becca. Her eyes were shining. I'm so grateful.
I smiled my wintry smile. I'm pleased to hear that, I said, and I was indeed pleased. Gratitude is valuable to me. I like to bank it for a rainy day. You never know when it may come in handy. Many are called, but few are chosen, I thought. Though that was not true at Arjuna Hall. Only a handful of the called have had to be discarded. Surely the girl Becca would be one of our keepers. She was a damaged houseplant, but cared for properly, she would bloom. Close the door after you, I said. She almost skipped out of the room. How young they are, how frisky, I thought, how touchingly innocent. Was I ever like that? I could not remember.
Part 14. Arjuna Hall.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 35. After Becca cut her wrist with the secateurs and bled on the Shasta daisies and was taken to the hospital, I was very worried about her. Would she recover? Would she be punished? But as the autumn and then the winter seasons came and went, there was still no news. Even our Marthas did not hear anything about what might have happened to her. Shunammite said Becca was just trying to get attention. I disagreed, and I'm afraid there was a coolness between us for the remainder of the classes. As the spring weather set in, Aunt Gabbana announced that the aunts had come up with three candidates for Paula and Commander Kyle to consider. She visited us at her house and showed us their photographs and recited their biographies and qualifications, reading from her notebook, and Paula and Commander Kyle listened and nodded. I was expected to look at the pictures and listen to the recital, but not to say anything at present. I could have a week to consider. My own inclinations would naturally be taken into account, said Aunt Gabbana. Paula smiled at this.
Of course, she said. I said nothing. The first candidate was a full commander and was even older than Commander Kyle.
He was red-nosed with slightly bulbous eyes, the mark, said Aunt Cabana, of a strong personality, one who would be a reliable defender and sustainer of his wife. He had a white beard and what looked like jowls underneath it, or possibly wattles, skin folds drooping down. He was one of the first sons of Jacob, and so was exceptionally godly, and had been essential in the early struggle to establish the Republic of Gilead. In fact, it was rumored that he had been part of the group that had masterminded the attack on the morally bankrupt Congress of the former United States. He'd already had several wives, dead, unhappily, and had been assigned 5 handmaids, but had not yet been gifted with children. His name was Commander Judd. Though I'm not sure this information is of much use if you are attempting to establish his true identity. Since the leading sons of Jacob had changed their names frequently when they were in the secret planning stages of Gilead. I knew nothing of these name changes at the time. I learned about them later, thanks to my excursions through the Bloodline's genealogical archives at Ardua Hall. But even there, Judd's original name had been obliterated. The second candidate was younger and thinner. His head was pointed at the top and he had oddly large ears. He was good with numbers, said Aunt Cabana, and intellectual, not always a desirable thing, especially not for women, but in a husband it could be tolerated. He had managed to have one child by his former wife, who had died in an asylum for mental sufferers. But the poor infant had expired before the age of 1. No, said Aunt Cabana. It had not been an unbaby. There was nothing wrong with it at birth. The cause was juvenile cancer, alarmingly on the rise. The third man, the younger son of a lower-ranking commander, was only 25. He had a lot of hair, but a thick neck and eyes that were close together. Not as excellent a prospect as the other two, said Aunt Cabana, but the family was highly enthusiastic about the match, which meant I would be properly appreciated by the in-laws. This was not to be discounted, since hostile in-laws could make a girl's life miserable. They would criticize and always side with the husband. Don't jump to any conclusions yet, Agnes, Aunt Cabana said. Take your time. Your parents want you to be happy. This was a kind thought, but a lie. They didn't want me to be happy. They wanted me to be elsewhere. I lay in bed that night with the 3 photographs of the eligible men floating in the darkness before my eyes. I pictured each one of them on top of me, for that is where they would be, trying to shove his loathsome appendage into my stone-cold body. Why was I thinking of my body as stone-cold, I wondered. Then I saw. It would be stone-cold because I would be dead. I would be as wan and bloodless as poor of Kyle had been, cut open to get her baby out, then lying still, wrapped in a sheet, staring at me with her silent eyes. There was a certain power in it, silence and stillness. Chapter 36. I considered running away from home, but how would I do that, and where could I go? I had no notion of geography. We did not study it in school, since our own neighborhood should be enough for us. And what wife needed more? I did not even know how big Gilead was. How far did it go? Where did it end? More practically, how would I travel? What would I eat? Where would I sleep? And if I did run away, would God hate me? Surely I would be pursued. Would I cause a lot of suffering to others, like the concubine cut into 12 pieces? The world was infested with men who were certain to be tempted by girls who'd strayed out of bounds. Such girls would be viewed as loose in their morals. I might not get any farther than the next block before being ripped to shreds, polluted, and reduced to a pile of wilting green petals. The week I'd been granted in which to choose my husband wore on. Paula and Commander Kyle favored Commander Judd. He had the most power. They put on a show of persuading me, since it was better if the bride was willing. There had been gossip about high-level weddings that had gone off badly, wailing, fainting, slaps administered by the mother of the bride. I'd overheard the Marthas saying that before some weddings, tranquilizing drugs had been administered with needles. They had to be careful with the dose. Mild, staggering, and slurred speech could be put down to emotion, a wedding being a hugely important moment in a girl's life. But a ceremony at which the bride was unconscious did not count. It was clear that I would be married to Commander Judd whether I liked it or not, whether I hated it or not. But I kept my aversion to myself and pretended to be deciding. As I say, I had learned how to act.
"Think what your position will be," Paula would say. "You couldn't ask for better."
Commander Judd was not young and would not live forever. And far though she was from wishing it, I would most likely survive much longer than he would, she said. And after he died, I would be a widow, with more leeway to choose my next husband. Think what a benefit that would be. Naturally, any male relatives, including those by marriage, would play a role in my choice of second husband. Then Paula would run down the qualifications of the other two candidates, disparaging their appearances, their characters, and their positions in life. She needn't have bothered. I detested both of them. Meanwhile, I was pondering other actions I might take. There were the French-style flower-arranging secateurs, like the ones Becca had used. Paula had some of those, but they were in the garden shed, which was locked. I'd heard of a girl who'd hanged herself with her bathrobe sash to avoid a marriage. Vera had told the story the year before, while the other two Marthas made sad faces and shook their heads.
"Suicide is a failure of faith," Zilla said.
"It makes a real mess," said Rosa.
"Such a slur on the family," said Vera.
There was bleach, but it was kept in the kitchen, as were knives, and the Marthas, being no fools and having eyes in the backs of their heads, were alert to my desperation. They'd taken to dropping aphorisms, such as, "Every cloud has a silver lining," and "The harder the shell, the sweeter the nut," and even, "Diamonds are a girl's best friend." Rosa went so far as to say, as if talking to herself,
"Once you're dead forever,"
while looking at me out of the sides of her eyes. There was no point in asking the Marthas to help me, not even Zilla. Sorry though they might feel for me, much as they might wish me well, they had no power to affect the outcome. At the end of the week, my engagement was announced. It was to Commander Judd, as it was always going to be. He appeared at the house in his full uniform with medals, shook hands with Commander Kyle, bowed to Paula, and smiled at the top of my head. Paula moved over to stand beside me, put her arm around my back, and rested her hand lightly on my waist. She had never done such a thing before. Did she think I would try to get away?
"Good evening, Agnes, my dear," said Commander Judd.
I focused on his medals. It was easier to look at them than at him.
You may say good evening,
Paula said in a low voice, pinching me slightly with the hand that was behind my back.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening,
I managed to whisper.
Sir.
The commander advanced, arranged his face into a jowly smile, and stuck his mouth onto my forehead in a chaste kiss. His lips were unpleasantly warm. They made a sucking sound as they pulled away. I pictured a tiny morsel of my brain being sucked through the skin of my forehead into his mouth. A thousand such kisses later, and my skull would be emptied of brain.
I hope to make you very happy, my dear, he said.
I could smell his breath. A blend of alcohol, mint mouthwash like that at the dentist's, and tooth decay. I had an unbidden image of the wedding night. An enormous, opaque white blob was moving towards me through the dusk of an unknown room. It had a head, but no face. Only an orifice like the mouth of a leech. From somewhere in its midsection, a third tentacle was waving around in the air. It reached the bed where I was lying paralyzed with horror, and also naked. You had to be naked. Or at least, naked enough, said Shunammite. What came next? I shut my eyes, trying to blank out the inner scene, then opened them again. Commander Judd drew back, regarding me shrewdly. Had I shuddered while he was kissing me? I had tried not to. Paula was pinching my waist harder. I knew I was supposed to say something, such as, thank you, or I hope so too, or I'm sure you will, but I could not manage it. I felt sick to my stomach. What if I threw up? Right now, on the carpet? That would be shameful. She's exceptionally modest, said Paula through tight lips, glaring sideways at me.
And that is a charming feature, said Commander Judd.
You may go now, Agnes Jemima, said Paula. Your father and the commander have things to discuss.
So I made my way towards the door. I was feeling a little dizzy.
She seems obedient,
I heard Commander Judd saying as I left the room.
Oh, yes, said Paula. She's always been a respectful child.
What a liar she was. She knew how much rage was seething inside me. The three wedding arrangers, Aunt Lorna, Aunt Sarah Lee, and Aunt Betty, made a return visit, this time to measure me for my wedding dress. They'd brought some sketches. I was asked to give my opinion about which dress I liked best. I pointed to one at random.
Is she well?
Aunt Betty asked Paula in a soft voice.
She looks quite tired.
It's an emotional time for them, Paula replied.
Oh, yes, said Aunt Betty. So emotional. You should have the Marthas make her a soothing drink, said Aunt Lorna. Something with chamomile.
Or a sedative. In addition to the dress, I was to have new underclothes and a special nightgown for the wedding night, with ribbon bows down the front. So easy to open. Like a gift-wrapped package.
I don't know why we are bothering with the frills, Paula said to the aunts talking past me. She won't appreciate them.
She won't be the one looking at them, said Aunt Sarah Lee with unexpected bluntness. Aunt Lorna gave a suppressed snort. As for the wedding dress itself, it was to be classical, said Aunt Sarah Lee. Classical was the best style. The clean lines would be very elegant, in her opinion.
a veil with a simple chaplet of cloth snowdrops and forget-me-nots. Artificial flower-making was one of the handicrafts encouraged among the Akano wives. There was a subdued conversation about lace trim, to add it, as Aunt Betty advised, because it would be attractive, or to omit it, which would be preferable in Paula's view, since attractive was not the main focus. Unspoken, the main focus was to get the thing over with and consign me to her past, where I would be tucked away, unreactive as lead, no longer combustible. No one would be able to say she had not done her duty as the wife of her commander and as an observant citizen of Gilead. The wedding itself would take place as soon as the dress was ready. Therefore, it was safe to plan it for 2 weeks from this day. Did Paula have the names of the guests she would like invited? Aunt Sarah Lee asked. The two of them went downstairs to compile, Paula to recite the names, Aunt Sarah Lee to write them down. The aunts would prepare and personally deliver the verbal invitations. It was one of their roles, to be the bearer of poisoned messages.
"Aren't you excited?" said Aunt Betty, as she and Aunt Lorna were packing up their sketches and I was putting my clothes back on. "In 2 weeks, you'll have your very own house."
There was something wistful in her voice. She herself would never have a house, but I paid no attention to it.
2 weeks, I thought. I had only 14 scant days of life left to me on this earth. How would I spend them?
Chapter 37. As the days ticked past, I became more desperate. Where was the exit? I had no gun. I had no lethal pills. I remembered a story circulated by Shunammite at school about someone's handmaid who had swallowed drain cleaner.
"The whole bottom part of her face came off," Shunammite had whispered with delight. "It just dissolved. It was like fizzing."
I hadn't believed her at the time, though now I did. A bathtub filled with water? But I would gasp and splutter and come up for air, and I couldn't attach a stone to myself in the bath, unlike in a lake or a river or the sea. But there was no way I could get to a lake or a river or the sea. Maybe I would have to go through with the ceremony, and then murder Commander Judd on the wedding night, stick a purloined knife into his neck, then into mine. There would be a lot of blood to get out of the sheets, but it wouldn't be me doing the scrubbing. I pictured the dismay on Paula's face when she walked into the slaughter chamber. Such a butcher shop. And there went her social standing. These scenarios were fantasies, of course. Underneath this web spinning, I knew I could never kill myself or murder anyone. I remembered Becca's fierce expression when she'd slashed her wrist. She'd been serious about it. She'd really been prepared to die. She was strong in a way that I was not. I would never have her resolve. At night, when I was falling asleep, I fantasized about miraculous escapes, but all of them required help from other people, and who would help me? It would have to be someone I didn't know, a rescuer, the warden of a hidden door, the keeper of a secret password. None of that seemed possible when I woke up in the morning. I went round and round in my head. What to do? What to do? I could barely think. I could scarcely eat. "Wedding nerves, bless her soul," said Zilla. I did want my soul to be blessed, but I could see no way of that happening. When there were only 3 days left, I had an unexpected visitor.
Zilla came up to my room to call me downstairs.
Aunt Lydia is here to see you, she said in hushed tones. Good luck. We all wish you that. Aunt Lydia.
The main founder, the gold-framed picture at the back of every schoolroom, the ultimate aunt, come to see me?
What had I done? I was shaking as I made my way down the stairs.
Paula was out, which was a lucky thing. Though after I came to know Aunt Lydia better, I realized that luck had nothing to do with it. Aunt Lydia was sitting on the sofa in the living room. She was smaller than she'd been at the funeral of Kyle. But perhaps that was because I'd grown. She actually smiled at me, a wrinkly, yellow-toothed smile.
Agnes, my dear, she said. I thought you might like to hear some news about your friend, Becca.
I was in such awe of her that it was hard for me to talk.
Is she dead? I whispered, my heart sinking.
Not at all. She is safe and happy.
Where is she?
I managed to stammer.
She is at Ardua Hall, with us. She wishes to become an aunt and is enrolled as a supplicant.
Oh, I said.
A light was dawning. A door was opening.
Not every girl is suitable for marriage, she continued. For some, it is simply a waste of potential. There are other ways a girl, or woman, may contribute to God's plan.
A little bird has told me that you may agree.
Who had told her? Zilla?
She'd sensed how violently unhappy I was. Yes, I said. Perhaps my prayers of long ago to Aunt Lydia had finally been answered, though in a different way than I'd expected.
Becca has received a call to higher service. If you yourself have such a calling, she said, you still have time to tell us.
But how do I don't know how.
I myself cannot be seen to be proposing this course of action directly, she said. It would contravene the prime right of the father to arrange the marriage of his daughter. A calling can override the paternal right, but you must make the first approach to us. I suspect Aunt Este would be willing to listen. If your calling proves strong enough, you will devise a way of contacting her.
But what about Commander Judd?
I asked timorously. He was so powerful. If I ducked the wedding, surely he would be very angry, I thought.
Oh, Commander Judd always has lots of choices, she said with an expression I couldn't read.
My next task was to find a pathway to Aunt Este. I could not declare my intention outright. Paula would stop me. She'd lock me in my room. She'd resort to drugs. She was hell-bent on this marriage. I used the expression hell-bent advisedly. She was risking her soul for it. Although, as I later learned, her soul was already in flames. The day after Aunt Lydia's visit, I made a request of Paula. I wanted to talk to Aunt Lorna about my wedding dress, which had already been tried on twice and was being altered. I wanted everything to be perfect for my special day, I said. I smiled. I thought the dress looked like a lampshade, but it was my plan to appear cheerful and appreciative. Paula gave me a sharp glance. I doubt that she believed in my smiling face. But if I was putting on an act, so much the better, as long as it was the kind of act she wanted.
I'm pleased you're taking an interest, she said dryly.
It's a good thing Aunt Lydia paid you a visit.
Naturally, she'd heard about that, though not about what was actually said. But it would be a nuisance for Aunt Lorna to come to our house, said Paula. It wasn't convenient, as I ought to have known. There was the food to be ordered, there were the flowers to be arranged. Paula couldn't deal with such a time-wasting visit. Aunt Lorna is at Shunammite's, I said. I knew that from Zilla. Shunammite's own wedding was also shortly to take place. In that case, our guardian could drive me over there, said Paula. I felt my heart quicken, partly in relief, partly in fear. Now I would have to carry through my risky plan. How did the Marthas know who was where? They weren't allowed Computox and couldn't receive letters. They must have known from other Marthas, though possibly from the aunts as well, and some of the wives. The aunts, the Marthas, the wives. Despite the fact that they were frequently envious and resentful, and might even hate one another, news flowed among them as if along invisible spiderweb threads. Our guardian driver was summoned and given instructions by Paula. I expect she was glad to have me out of the house. My unhappiness must have given off a sour smell that was irritating to her. Shunammite used to say that they put happy pills into the warm milk of girls who were about to get married. But no one had been putting happy pills in mine. I climbed into the back seat of our car while our guardian held the door open for me. I took a deep breath, half exhilaration, half terror. What if my attempt at deception should fail? And what if it should succeed? Either way, I was heading into the unknown. I did consult Aunt Lorna, who was indeed at Shunammite's house. Shunammite said it was fun to see me, and once we were married, we could visit a lot. She hurried me inside and took me to inspect her wedding dress, and to hear all about the husband she would soon have, who, she whispered, giggling, looked like a carp with a receding chin and goggly eyes, but who was medium high up among the commanders. Wasn't that exciting? I said. I admired the dress, which, I told Shunammite, was much fancier than mine. Shunammite laughed and said she'd heard I was practically marrying God. My new husband was so important, and wasn't I lucky? And I gazed downwards and said, but anyway, her dress was nicer. She was pleased by that, and said she was sure we would both get through the sex part and not make a fuss. We would follow Aunt Lise's instructions and think about arranging flowers in a vase, and it would all be over quickly, and maybe we would even have real babies. By ourselves, without handmaids. She asked if I would like an oatmeal cookie, and she sent the Martha for some. I took one and nibbled at it, though I was not hungry. I couldn't stay long, I said, because there was so much to do, but could I see Aunt Lorna? We found her across the hall in one of the spare rooms, poring over her notebook. I asked her to add something or other to my dress. A white bow, a white frill, I can't remember. I said goodbye to Shunammite and thanked her for the cookie, and said again how lovely her dress was. I went out the front door, waving cheerfully just like a real girl, and walked to our car. After that, heart hammering, I asked our driver if he wouldn't mind stopping by my old school, since I wished to thank my former teacher, Aunt Este, for everything she had taught me. He was standing beside the car, holding the back door open for me. He gave me a suspicious frown.
Those aren't my instructions, he said.
I smiled in what I hoped was a charming way. My face felt stiff, as if it was covered with hardening glue. It's quite safe, I said. Commander Kyle's wife won't mind. Aunt Este is an aunt. It's her job to take care of me.
Well, I don't know, he said dubiously. I looked up at him. I'd never paid much attention to him before, since usually I had only the back view. He was a torpedo-shaped man, small at the top end, thick in the middle. He had not shaved carefully and had bristles and a rash. "I'll be married soon," I said. "To a very powerful commander. More powerful than Paula. Than Commander Kyle's wife." I paused to let this sink in. And then, I am ashamed to say, I placed my hand lightly on top of his, where it was holding the car door. "I'll make sure you're rewarded," I said. He flinched slightly and pinkened.
"Well then," he said, though he didn't smile.
So this is how women get things done, I thought. If they are prepared to wheedle and lie and go back on their word. I was disgusted with myself. But you'll notice this didn't stop me. I smiled again and pulled my skirt up just a little, displaying an ankle as I swiveled my legs into the car.
"Thank you,"
I said. "You won't be sorry." He drove me to my old school as I'd requested, and talked to the angels guarding it, and the double gate swung open and I was driven inside. I told the driver to wait for me. I wouldn't be long. Then I walked sedately into the school building, which now seemed much smaller than when I'd left it. It was after hours. I was lucky that Aunt Este was still there. Though again, it may not have been luck. She was sitting at her desk in her usual classroom, writing in her notebook. She looked up when I came in.
"Why, Agnes," she said. "You're all grown up."
I hadn't planned beyond this moment. I wanted to throw myself on the floor in front of her and burst into tears. She'd always been kind to me. "They're making me marry a horrible, disgusting man," I said. "I'll kill myself first." Then I really did burst into tears and crumpled onto her desk. It was acting in a way, and probably bad acting, but it was real acting, if you see what I mean. Aunt Este lifted me up and walked me to a chair.
"Sit down, my dear," she said, "and tell me all about it."
She asked me the questions she was duty-bound to ask. Had I considered how this marriage might affect my future positively? I told her that I knew about the benefits, but I didn't care about them because I had no future, not of that kind. "What about the other candidates?" she asked. "Would anyone else be preferable?" "They were not any better," I said, and anyway, Paula had made up her mind about Commander Judd. Was I in earnest about killing myself? I said I was, and that if I didn't manage it before the wedding, I would be sure to do it afterwards. And I would kill Commander Judd the first time he laid a finger on me. I would do it with a knife, I said. I would cut his throat. I said this with conviction so she would see that I was capable of it. And for that moment, I believed I was. I could almost feel the blood as it came pouring out of him. And then my own blood as well. I could almost see it. A haze of red. Aunt Este didn't say I was very wicked, as Aunt Vidala might have done. Instead, she said that she understood my distress.
"But is there another way you feel you might contribute to the greater good? Have you perhaps had a call?"
I'd forgotten about that part, but now I remembered.
"Oh, yes," I said. "Yes, I have. I'm called to higher service."
Aunt Este gave me a long and searching look. Then she asked me if she could pray silently. She needed guidance about what to do. I watched while she folded her hands, closed her eyes, and bowed her head. I held my breath.
"Please, God, send her the right message," I prayed in my turn. Finally, she opened her eyes and smiled at me. "I will speak with your parents," she said. "And with Aunt Lydia."
"Thank you,"
I said. I was beginning to cry again, this time with relief. "Do you want to come with me?" she said. "To talk with your parents?" "I can't," I said.
"They'll get hold of me and lock me in my room, and then they'll give me a drug. You know they will."
She didn't deny it. "That's sometimes best," she said. "But for you, I think not. You can't stay here at the school, however. I couldn't stop the eyes from entering and removing you and changing your mind. You don't want the eyes doing that. You'd better come with me." She must have evaluated Paula and judged that she'd be capable of anything. I didn't know then how Aunt Este had come by this information about Paula, but I know now. The aunts had their methods and their informants. No walls were solid for them, no doors locked. We went outside and she told my driver to let his commander's wife know that she was sorry for having kept Agnes Jemima so long, and she hoped that no undue worry had been caused. Also, he should say that she, Aunt Este, was about to pay Commander Kyle's wife a visit to decide an important